This is Joe LaCroix. If you haven't met Joe yet, unless if any of you would do not want to have your picture taken, it's okay. Just let us know. Get out of the room.
No way, but.
But Joe's taking pictures for the Juan Dharma Center, and he's going to send me some the pictures too. And we'll put them up on the website. So.
As long as I wasn't relaxing my belly, I'm okay.
Which translates as long as we review them first. It's all good. So snap away.
Joe, do you want to just take some pictures, or do you want us to be a certain way?
What would serve you guys? What pictures would make you guys happy?
Pictures of John.
We're a pretty happy bunch. No matter what kind of pictures
John
you get.
John in this beautiful spot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would like if you could get a group shot after lunch, that would be great.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, can you, with that backlight, can you get a good shot? I know I couldn't.
Well, at first I thought it was the glare behind him, but it's just a natural halo.
It's trying to tell us that from here.
Yeah, well, if I may keep
but
going
it,
on.
It took a truly awakened soul to notice it.
Great speech.
It takes one to see. Somebody impossible.
I'm gonna start once who takes this picture. So the first thing, most important thing, is Happy Mother's Day to the mothers. And to all of our mothers, you know. Mine was particularly wonderful, and I'm sure yours were as well, mm-hmm. too. A few logistical things. You notice on the back of your door how the Juan Dharma Center would like us to police our rooms in the area. When we're pretty well done, if a few people could just sweep the floors, including downstairs, there's not much to be done. I don't know that we need to mop the floors. The only person that walks through here with shoes is me, and my feet don't touch the floor anyway. So no mopping required.
That's not what I
hear. My feet don't touch the floor, but my cane does.
Go stick. One noise feet make the other.
It's like belling the cat.
Hami, what a great cat. Even the cat is perfect up here, isn't it? A few more logistical things. When we finish our lunch, I'd like to ask the kitchen staff to come out, and if we could, I'm going to say a few quick words, and if we could give them a bow. If Karen's there, she needs to be acknowledged. It's amazing how much work she does, which means I don't have to. And we should acknowledge the ministers and the staff. So we got three good bows coming up right after lunch.
And the kitchen staff is interchangeable. I mean, they're all different people doing things at different times.
Doing the work, yeah.
Yeah, but they just what an amazing
right, see,
job.
They're you know, who's ever there today, they all really pitch in, and I've seen everybody in there doing different things.
Yeah. There was something else, police, the place, this and that.
Pictures.
We got pictures. I think that's it. So there's a group hug after lunch. there's a lot of material that I'd like to go over this morning before, and we really should get done by 11 o'clock. There's actually two suttas that I want to touch on. One will lead to this to the other one, and it has to do with becoming something that well. So we're going to have a short meditation this morning. Rather than half an hour, we'll do 10 minutes. Is that okay? We've been doing a lot of meditation. In fact, the real meditators are up at 5 o'clock this morning, me and Kevin. So,
so we'll, see one of them at 7 for any of the sessions.
So let's do it. We'll just do a quick meditation. So there was something I wanted to say earlier, and it's actually something that I wanted to say Thursday night, but I forgot because I was so excited to get started. The meditation method that the Buddha taught is the simplest action that anybody can take, even though some of us find it difficult at times, because it is, because we're trying to quiet a mind that doesn't want to quiet down. We're trying to deepen concentration. So the Buddha taught meditation for that singular purpose, to deepen concentration. Meditation is not contemplation, cultivation, or examination. It's concentration. The reason why I say that is that it's an aspect of a mind that's seeking distraction that will even bring what seemingly are wholesome or reasonable practices within a meditation practice and call it meditation. And I'm not saying that don't ever do anything other than shamatha vipassana meditation, but since I settled on this, I haven't found the need to do any of the other things that I was doing before. Because I realized that, well, for one thing, I don't want to waste my meditation time on something else that does not fall into the framework of the Eightfold Path. I don't want to do anything else that might distract me from using that time, whether it's 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, or 30 minutes, or an hour, to deepen concentration. And the most effective way of doing that is to be mindful of the sensation of breathing. When we get into other practices, we're likely really introducing an excuse for further distraction, or at the very best, something that's not going to develop concentration. So again, meditation is for deepening concentration, and it's taught as part of the framework of the Eightfold Path, which guides our entire practice as we know. Okay, the Kakai. Does anybody have any questions about what I just said? So I'm not saying that other methods aren't legitimate, but if we're going to develop the Eightfold Path, look at meditation as for deepening concentration. That's why the Buddha taught it. And again, I've read a lot of the suttas. I've never come across anything else that the Buddha said to do anything else. He never taught to use the breath for any other thing but to deepen concentration. And he taught the four foundation. I think one of the reasons why he taught the four foundation of mindfulness is so we don't get into other things. In other words, start examining our feelings or examining our thoughts. Simply recognize that we're caught up in our thinking, we're caught up in a feeling, come back to the sensation of breathing. And it's primarily off our cushion that we'll gain insight into these things that we might otherwise use meditation for.
How could you examine a thought if a thought is just coming out of ignorance? Why would you want to
yeah.
examine it?
Yeah.
The Buddha could have never taught that.
No, of course. But the reason why I'm saying it, there's a lot of so-called meditation practices that are taught to, something comes up, get into it deeply, examine it deeply, cultivate the feeling, cultivate the thought. That's fine, but it's not what the Buddha taught. And if you find that you would like to do that, I'm not saying don't. I don't find any value in it. But don't make that part of your practice. Make it something else. And I would say don't even do it at the same time. And maybe don't even do it in the same setting. But
so conceptually, I can see where contemplative meditation, people might think that it's a way to bring insight. But in my experience, it's the deepening the concentration that brings the insight.
Yes, within the proper framework.
Right, within the proper framework, that there's no, for me personally, there's no functional application of a contempt, because it's a distraction to
yes.
me.
Yes.
That the insights for me come between the developing the concentration and the learning that takes place within our conversations.
Yeah, and within the integration of the. In other words, if the Eightfold Path provides the framework for useful insight, we know what we're looking for, and we know it when we see it. We're not just wandering around in mind. And an overriding aspect of the Eightfold Path is to learn to practice restraint, isn't it? And it's most important in our meditation practice to practice restraint, to not feel the need to introduce something else. And you can really tell yourself when you feel like you want to do that, practice restraint, because you're really just looking for a way to distract yourself while saying, I'm meditating every day. Practice restraint there, most important there. I need to be mindful of the time. The Kakaya Yanagata Sutta. The Buddha was staying at Savatthi at Jiva's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. The monk Kakayanagata approached the Buddha with a question. I don't understand right view. Can you teach me how right view relates to the world? And again, relates to the whole Dhamma practice. Kakayana, the confusion and deluded thinking in the world arises from polarizing views. There is the view of a permanent existence, and actually I put the word in there, permanent. There is a view of existence and there is a view of non-existence. When the origination of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view it is seen that non-existence does not occur. Furthermore, when the cessation of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view it is seen that existence does not occur. The world is sustained by attachments, by clinging to conditioned thinking and wrong views, rooted in ignorance, I interject, of Four Noble Truths. One who has developed right view no longer clings to attachments or fixated thinking, meaning conditioned thinking, or self-obsession. It is understood that stress arising is simply stress arising. We don't need to do anything. The First Noble Truth, dukkha, occurs. No matter how it's occurring, it's just occurring. Stress is arising. It is understood that stress passing away is simply stress passing away. Notice there's no personalization in either one of those aspects of stress. It's arising. It's not arising to me or because of me. It's just arising. In fact, you could say it's arising because I'm here, period. Because I'm living in the world. It has nothing to do with me. And it's passing away. This is probably even more important. Has nothing to do with me. It's an aspect of impermanence. And when you can really understand that, then you'll stop manipulating the world around you because there's nothing you can do about it.
Can I just ask, this is not me that you are eye-raking or getting having contact with the phenomenal world. You've made a contact for that for the stress to arise, and that's the fault, but that's where you're wandering off the path.
It's an outstanding question. Thank you. When the Buddha describes suffering, stress, he described it first in terms of things that we do not cause. It's simply a consequence of living in the world: birth, sickness, aging, and death. And then he gets into our contribution of stress. We react to not getting what we want, or we react to getting what we don't want. And then he always concludes it. In short, the five clinging aggregates, the personal experience of stress. So that first aspect, simply living in the world, there is going to be stress. And that stress is going to arise and it's going to pass away. Unless we start clinging to it through eye-making, through saying, I don't want to have this experience, or I better not have this experience again, or I want more of this experience. That's the eye-making part of it. Is that clear? So simply observing the stress in the world is not eye-making, but personalizing it is.
I got you.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Is everybody else? It's really an important question, isn't it? Because
you just don't attach to it.
Yes, what you're describing when you attach to it is creating that feedback loop that the Buddha talked about.
The ignorance.
Yep. Stress arising is stress arising. It is understood that stress passing away is stress passing away. In this way, their knowledge is independent of other views. The Buddha is already making a distinction of other practices and understanding. This is independent of that. This is a unique way of looking at stress arising and stress passing away. This is how right view relates to the world. The view that everything exists is a wrong view, and the view that nothing exists is another wrong view. Now remember, the Buddha studied with teachers that were teaching this view, this extreme view of nothingness, as a place to aspire to or to develop. I mean, it's even hard for me to describe it because there's no way to get there because it doesn't exist. Yet it's presented as a concept, and the Buddha's recognized it, and he's saying, "Don't go there. It's a wrong view." Then he continues, "My Dhamma avoids extreme views. I teach from the middle. I teach the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views." Again, how do we recognize extreme or conditioned views? Through the Eightfold Path. Through a mind that is, maybe that's why I saved that, even though I didn't do it on purpose, saved that little talk about meditation. That's why we need concentration. To recognize when we're going into extreme views. "I teach the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views. The middle way shows that suffering originates and is dependent on ignorance. I'm going to go through dependent origination one more time, if you don't mind. From ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, as in I interjected that of the Four Noble Truths, I'll read it the way it's often written. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrication. Remember, to keep making the point, everything that flows from ignorance is going to cause suffering, meaning in a general way, disappointment, unsatisfactoriness, extreme emotional and physical suffering. The next step in that is creating assumptions, mental fabrications rooted in ignorance. If there's no ignorance, there's no assumptions or wrong views. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. Are you following me in a general way now of how this develops?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty incredible because it took me years to follow this. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base, our five physical senses, and resulting consciousness rooted in ignorance. Nothing there that's worth protecting or defending. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. Now, I'm going to the other sutta that I wanted to talk about has to do directly with becoming. So, from becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. Now, we know it's not just physical birth, but giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. Giving birth to another moment that is prone to be disappointing and unsatisfactory in some way. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. Such is the origination of extreme views and the entire mass of confusion, delusion, and stress. Now, from the remainder...
Did you put extreme in there, or is that in there? What do you think?
Oh, no, that's the translation.
Extreme
views. Again, why wouldn't the Buddha use that? Because he's trying to explain that his path is the middle way between extreme views. So he used that reference often. In fact, one of the reasons why I'm teaching this now and included in the book is because it's another way of looking at dependent origination in the situation that Kakayana is using it. Teach me right view. He brings it back to dependent origination. This is right view. Now, from the remainderless fading away, fading and cessation of that very ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. And that we could really stop there, couldn't we? From the fading away, from the remainderless fading away. Every time I write that, I get the spell. Yeah, it's not right. You can't say remainderless. It's a wrong word. It fits, doesn't it? From there, there's nothing left. From the remainderless fading away, there's not a speck of ignorance left, comes the cessation of fabrications. So why am I? How come I'm not going to stop there? Well, from the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness. And this is where we can get lost. But remember that it's what we need to be concerned about is that first step, the foundation of everything that follows. If we deal with ignorance, we don't even have to consider everything that follows. But the teaching of dependent origination shows what happens within us. Our thinking becomes skewed. We can't rely on our feelings anymore. We can't even rely on our senses anymore because we're rooted in ignorance. What happens when we develop awakening, full human maturity? We can rely on our senses again. We can act appropriately from our feelings because now we're acting from wisdom. From the cessation of consciousness comes, and maybe that's the best way to look at this. Look at this is what we're doing. This is not something we have to so much understand. Recognize the experience of it. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form, self-referential views. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. In other words, relying on our senses rooted in ignorance to define our reality and define ourselves. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. No more craving. No more needing. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. No more holding on. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming, and I'll get to that in a minute. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. All the things we don't want to experience. Such is the cessation of this entire mass of stress and suffering. Now this, monks, is a noble truth of stress. Notice how simple it is. Got to keep hearing it again to realize
that.
What
was that you just said? This.
Such is the cessation of this entire mass of stress and suffering. Now this, monks, is the noble truth.
Okay, monks.
The noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are stressful. He's just describing living in the world, isn't he? Nothing we can do about that part of it. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from what is loved is stressful. That's certainly true, isn't it? Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. Again, the five clinging aggregates is the personal experience of suffering. You can call it anatta. You can call it confirmation bias, conditioned thinking. You can even somewhat accurately call it karma, because it's the unfolding personal experience of what you've set in motion through your acts, through your intentional acts. The craving that makes, and this, monks, is a noble truth of the origination of stress, where it comes from. The craving that makes for further becoming. I am going to get to the Bhavan Sutta, the Sutta on becoming. Further becoming what? Further becoming a self rooted in ignorance. That's what he's referring to here. Again, keeping it in context. Craving that makes for further becoming of an ignorant self. Nobody likes to hear that, do you? Accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there. I.e., for example, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, and the letting go of that very craving. A good way to see that and experience it is to recognize, or the letting go of craving is to be a complete peace with the people and events of your life as they occur, as they unfold, including yourself. That's the cessation of craving. Nothing needs to be any different than it is. And remember, that doesn't mean that you have to approve of it. In fact, if you get into needing to approve or not, you're stuck. You're in the feedback loop. But you accept it. Why? Because it's simply what occurs. You understand, as a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be sickness, aging, and death. No need to worry about that. Can't do anything about it. There's going to be disappointment, but why react? Because that's part of having a human life too. We're not always going to get what we want. So what? Let go of the craving, the need for it to be any different than it is. And this, monks, is... I'm sorry.
Can you say that thing about... craving again, how to let go of craving in regards to people and places and things in your life?
You mean from this or what I just said?
What you just said.
I don't remember.
All right.
I can't. maybe this is what you're referring to. Being at peace with the people and events of our lives as they occur. Thank you for allowing me to emphasize that. This is the culmination of the path. It really is. It almost sounds too simple, maybe, or too mundane, or too matter-of-fact to be of any value, and it's the whole point. Continually being at peace with the people and events of our lives, including ourselves, as they unfold, as they occur. Another way of saying that is getting back to the useful definition of feelings, a disturbance in the mind. Having a mind that is free of disturbance. Another word for that is equanimity, a mind of equanimity. Nothing can occur. Once the defilements are gone, there's nothing left to disturb the mind. What occurs in that mind? The ability to be present with what is occurring without any distraction. without any need for life to be as it's occurring to be any different than it is. And most importantly, within ourselves, to have that radical acceptance of who I am in this moment is who I am. Not, I'm okay, you're okay. None of that judgment. This is simply, this is what's occurring. And also the profound understanding that if I, this sustenance is a word that's often used, if I provide the right sustenance, then this will become a constant state of comfort and peace for me. Is there any self-identification in that? No. It's simply a reference point. Mm-hmm. Instead of, I am at peace, there is peace. And if you can get to that point, and you all can, and I think you're going to get there before noon today, then there, if there's peace, if there is peace, then there is peace. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
There's peace here, and there's peace there.
Yeah.
Here, there, and everywhere. And there can't be peace here, there, and everywhere, unless there's peace here. Mm. Unless I am at peace with the people and events of their lives, including myself, as they occur. Let me continue. I could go on and on, but I really want to get this done. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. I really hope you're understanding and not getting disgusted with me and how I keep repeating things.
No.
Because this really makes the point. And this monks, I'm going to do it again. And this monks is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. The Buddha's words 2600 years ago and about 2600 times this weekend. Precisely this noble eightfold path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. The end of the sutta. It's another sutta where you can say that.
That's
where it came.
That was in there.
So
2600 years ago.
So you can say that the entire Buddha's teaching is in that sutta too, couldn't you?
Yes.
And every other one, if you understand the context, every single sutta is a complete teaching. Yeah.
That's why I call it the playbook.
Yeah. Now there's one more. Oh, we got plenty of time. I don't have to rush through this at all. There's one more sutta that I want to. This isn't even in the book, but I think I'm going to have to revise the book.
Samsara.
It's called the Bhava Sutta, which means becoming.
Which means what?
Becoming. Bhava. The Venerable Ananda, everybody knows who Ananda is now, right? Ananda went to the Buddha and on arrival bowed down to him and sat to one side. That's just a sign of respect. As he was sitting there, he said to the Buddha, Lord, this word, becoming, to what extent is there becoming? What the hell does it mean? Ananda, if there were no karma ripening in the sensuality property, five clinging aggregates, would sensuality becoming be discerned?
Wait,
no,
could you say that again?
Sure.
Sensuality becoming be discerned. Is that what you said?
Yes. Could you even understand it?
Yeah.
Would you recognize that it's going on?
I just couldn't hear the words for sensuality becoming be discerned.
Thus, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture.
Mm-hmm. Karma
meaning,
is the field,
consciousness is the seed, and craving
consciousness rooted in ignorance.
Yes, it's not. Again, it's so easy. We start applying. We hear the word consciousness. It's some grand consciousness. Consciousness rooted in ignorance, and craving the moisture. Nothing can survive without. They're looking for life. They're looking for life on planets. The first thing they're looking for is moisture.
Interesting.
Suffering can't survive without craving. This is something I read years ago, and I didn't even remember it until Ram and I have been talking about the finite definition of becoming, and that's what got me to think about it.
Karma is the field.
Consciousness is the field.
All right, great. Thank you. So, karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions.
Okay.
And I'm going to leave the second part that I usually do because that really doesn't apply here. Karma is the situation we put ourselves in from ignorance. Mm-hmm. So you could also say ignorance is the field. But it's actions resulting in ignorance is karma.
So if we stop creating more ignorant actions, the karma becomes extinguished.
There's no field for the plant of suffering and further ignorance to grow. Mm-hmm. That's what the Buddha said. That's becoming. Glad I remembered this. The consciousness of living beings is hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. What does fettered mean?
Attached to it and fettered by craving.
And is established in tune to a middling property, something that is of no value at all, a middling property. Thus, there is a production of renewed becoming in the future. That's becoming. Because we're cultivating the field of our karma through the sustenance of craving, we can only grow further ignorance. If there were no karma, ripening in the formless property, would formless becoming be discerned? No, it wouldn't. Thus, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. The consciousness of living beings, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, is established in tune to a refined property. And that, a better word than refined, because we think refined is something positive. In fact, I use it to describe refined mindfulness. Would be a useless property. It's just an affected property. Thus, there is the production of renewed becoming in the future. Now he answers the question. This is how there is becoming. This is how there is becoming.
What's the name of that sutra?
The Bhava Sutta, Bhava.
It's in the book, right?
It will be. It's not. Oh. It's not. It's something that I read years ago, and you know, it's kind of been in there, but I didn't really think about it again until Ram and I had these discussions on becoming.
Did you download the book again?
Yep.
I borrowed it.
Good.
I think what I like about that analogy is that if you can sort of extinguish suffering at any one of those three points, craving or the consciousness or
yes.
the karma.
And that relates to dependent origination,
or
too.
Or like recognize any of them in those places.
At any one of those links.
Yeah.
If you undo the link, unbind from it, the whole thing falls apart. You know, and in that way, it's a really simple and direct path. We know what we have to do.
Those are the keys to the castle.
Yeah. And I think what we've been able to develop is that the path is sometimes very intricate, but it's also utterly simple. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I gave that little talk about meditation, but also how I keep focusing on, again, there is some intricacies to it, but we don't need to be concerned about that. Keep your practice simple.
Well,
because it is simple.
What's so attractive about what we're doing here is the simplicity. You've heard many people say that.
Yeah.
So we know that it can be complicated, but until you build this foundation, you can't really progress into more than that. You really have to build the simplicity of the foundation in order to...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it is a self-referential mind that insists on simple things being complicated. Why? Because then you can continue ignorance. The complication is the distraction. It allows for further ignorance.
Right. Yeah, my situation is different.
Or all the things we come up with, why I don't have 10 minutes to sit and maybe 5 more minutes to contemplate the Eightfold Path and to even be mindful of it. That's whenever that happens. This is not me. This is not mine. This is something I'm trying to bring to cessation. You know, the remainderless fading away of that very craving. And it comes up in such subtle ways, doesn't it? That's why we need a well-concentrated mind. That's why we need to practice restraint. Especially, now that I brought it up this way, especially in meditation, but in all areas of our life. Every time we can recognize the I-making in our life and practice restraint, in other words, don't give in to it, We're diminishing conditioned thinking. We're diminishing that seemingly insatiable ego personality.
The habit.
Yeah, it is. It's another a good, simple term to use. It's just a habit to keep suffering going. But it's a very entrenched habit. Warren?
You weren't here, but I talked about that a little bit this morning, that these are all these habits that have evolved when we were not fully mature human beings to keep, you know, the species going from whatever, you know. Yeah. They're not mature, integrated, worthwhile habits. And that what we get, as you've been saying, and what the Buddha's words say, is we get to be free of all that and actually live a life of meaning, joy, purpose.
Yeah. Wow, I wish I came to your meditation this morning. I might have learned something. I don't mean that flippantly. You have a great grasp of this. You bring up something. That fight or flight thing, you know, that came back from the caveman days. We needed it to survive, and we've created a society where we're far removed from that. Most of the people, anyway. You know, there's still a lot of violence in the world, etc. But in Frenchtown, New Jersey, we don't need to be concerned about a mastodon stomping us or anything like that. We've created a situation that is potentially very conducive to developing the Dhamma. But yet we've become attached to the comfort, haven't we? And that comfort itself, millions of years of evolution, has become its own distraction rather than a support that it could be.
Right, so by developing concentration, the Eightfold Path, you can see through that, you can use insight into the nature of your self-suffering and impermanence, and choose wisely and appropriately what is appropriate to be concerned about and what isn't appropriate to be concerned about.
Yes, and we can do it in relative comfort and safety than our ancestors had, than even the Buddha had, even though some of his was by intention. And look at where we are. I mean, one of the reasons why this place is here and why we keep coming back here is because it provides the perfect place where we don't have to be concerned about even cooking for ourselves. You know, I'm making that point that we could do a much cheaper, less expensive retreat if we took on some of the other duties that they're taking care of, like cooking and all the rest of it. We don't have to do it. We're here in a situation, in an environment that is so conducive to awakening.
We could go stay home and go out on alms rounds.
Yeah. And probably get arrested today if we did that. We can't do that today. So it's a simple, very direct path. When it does seem complicated, or it seems like we are complicating it, just recognize it's not, and that's something that you're doing yourself. The Eightfold Path is the only path the Buddha ever taught. All the other things that we've talked about this weekend are hopefully to give you insight into how to develop the Eightfold Path. So you don't need to be too concerned about dependent origination. You don't even need to be too concerned about the five clinging aggregates, except to recognize that you're it. But you don't have to analyze it.
That's kind of what this sutta is doing. It's like the Buddha gives you, if you're getting stuck on dependent origination, he just pulled out like the five clinging aggregate engine, you know? It's like karma,
that's right,
consciousness, craving, and, you know, where it becomes. So he just, if you're getting caught up on that, you know, you don't even get these first four aggregates. You're already there if you're in ignorance. You skip that. Don't even worry about it. Feelings, it doesn't matter. You're already in the loop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And karma is interrupted by the Eightfold Path. And then we directly have the experience of interrupting that process in meditation. Every time we find that when we're caught up in our thinking, we're caught up in dukkha. And when we come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting that process, even though it's, for most of us, momentary. And every time we do that, we're conditioning our minds to be deconditioned from ignorance. And we're creating the conditions for awakening. Every moment. And that's not to be overlooked. That's another rather profound understanding. Every moment has the potential towards awakening. Why waste it? Why waste it in distraction? Why waste it in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking? Why waste it in becoming? Unless it's becoming awakened. Unless it's becoming Buddha. And I pitched it. I pitched the book. Yeah, yours today for only.
Find out when you get the revised edition. Yeah. First subscribers get the revised edition.
Awakening in 348 pages.
No, 349.
Yeah, by the way. That thing's going
to
be, it's going to be a cinder block.
But version 2 to awaken.
Well, that's the other books now. I was telling Maura, and I think Matt, that I've kind of written enough about how to do it. I think the next books are just going to be collections of sutras, of course, with my...
Or the seven secret laws.
Yeah, the seven secret laws of success. Abhitabha Jani.
The best barber in L.A.
Well, okay, so I got done a little quicker than I thought I might. But, so let's, any questions that might be lingering? Mm-hmm. Kevin?
As you're meditating, contradiction, maybe thoughts of the Eightfold Path pervade your mind. They're to be abandoned also during meditation and concentrating on your breathing.
Yes. Yeah, I would say. Because again, you could easily start pondering, you know, the depths of suffering. Or am I in right view or wrong view right at this moment? You're missing the opportunity at that moment to deepen your concentration. The Eightfold Path is the framework for how we live our life moment by moment, more or less off our cushion, except that eighth factor of right meditation. And the more that you can spontaneously recognize when you're in right view or wrong view, right intention or wrong intention, et cetera, that's how the Eightfold Path has meaning and how it's easily integrated. Is in application. So it's not so much as human beings, the way we learn is we first intellectualize something, we first study it, we look at it, we learn what it is. Just like if you learn how to change the oil in your car, you're probably first going to go on the internet and study how somebody does it. That doesn't mean you can do it until you do it. So you can read about the Eightfold Path, but until you actually integrate it into your life, ehepasiko. You have to come and see for yourself, does it have any real meaning and purpose? And so, again, that could be another trap in meditation. You know, come back to the sensation of breathing. And always remember, even if you're...
Like a clinging craving. Right?
Yeah.
Intention will move that forward.
Well, yeah, right intention is very similar to right effort in that we can use it to guide what we're doing. In other words, if we hold in mind the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, we'll recognize when we're doing it, if we have a little bit of concentration. There was a friend, still a friend of mine, years ago we got into a rather, I wouldn't say heated, but long-running argument or discussion about his intention. Does intention have any part in Buddhism? And his position was it didn't. You know what I'm talking about. And he still thinks that way, that intention has nothing to do with it. Intention is everything.
It's a very specific intention.
Yeah.
It's not, was I looking to get, blah, 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 was I trying to be helpful, was it, it's letting go of clinging and craving.
Yeah. It's not the intention to awaken.
Right.
If you got that intention, let it go. It's going to really lead you to someplace. I mean, I had that intention, and I read that book, and it actually worked until I realized it didn't. I was awake for about 16 hours.
Did you see any pictures?
Yeah, I wish I did.
Selfie.
I think it would have come out a little bit like Alfred E. Newman. Yeah, I'm awake. What, me worry?
Maybe he was awakened.
I don't think so. So, any other questions or comments?
Well,
I'm going to have to read that again.
Mm-hmm. The Baba?
Yeah.
Can you do that on a Tuesday or a Saturday?
Yeah, that would be good.
That's a really good one. Just, you know, just...
I will.
Put it into...
Oh, I think I already sent the email out for this week.
Well,
another week
as well. Yeah, I'll do it as soon as it fits in. It'll probably be next Tuesday, I would bet. I don't think I'd schedule that.
Do you find it in Tennis Arms work?
I think it is. I think it's, it's from Access to Insight.
Very difficult.
So did you do a search on Access to Insight?
It is. It's one of Tanisara Bhikkhu's articles.
Yeah, Access to Insight, and you can download.
Right. Yeah. No, I understand, but like that, I said, is that how you? Because we've been talking about him coming, and if you.
Oh no, I had it in the Kindle, but yeah, if you went on Access to Insight and did a search on the BHAVA Bhava Sutta, you'll see it.
Or
can you
coming,
actually search the whole text in that site? Or do you have to just search for the actual suttas, the names of the suttas?
Oh, you could do a search on becoming, and you probably find this, but you might find other things too. It would probably be useful.
500 hits on
that. Yeah, but BHAVA. Yeah, again, a very simple teaching, isn't it? On something that throughout Buddhist history, nobody knows what becoming is. Nobody knows how to apply it. Here's a simple teaching that Buddha gave 2,600 years ago, explaining it to Ananda. This is it. And it's when you see it in the right context, it's not hard to understand, is it?
This habit of saying becoming, like you find it in lots of suttas. What was that? Was that just a way of is this short for something?
No, I think it's one of the problems. It's not a problem, it's just the way it occurs. Most of the people that take on the responsibility of translating the suttas are very sincere. In fact, some maybe even too sincere, because the Pali language is there's so many different meanings to one single word. Like, for instance, dukkha. Dukkha covers everything in the phenomenal world, really. And again, you have to know how it's applied. And the other thing is that they all have had their own influences. And you cannot help but mold something to fit that view when you're making that translation. You just can't. I'm guilty of that too. I don't know if I use the word guilty. What I have done, if you haven't noticed, in most of my writings, especially in the last couple of years, is I've altered the translation enough to first get rid of a lot of repetition. It's unnecessary, even though I leave a lot. And always to use the words that are more modern and relate to the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. So, again, to answer your question, so the original Pali language, there's a very few people that can translate from the Pali. Tanisara is one of them. But most of the translations come from either German texts or Chinese texts, the Agamas. And so those are obviously one or two steps.
Pictorial language, it was a conceptual. Each character is a concept rather than a letter.
But sometimes it fits better in the Pali, because Pali is a language that's constructed of a root and then prefixes and suffixes.
Yeah.
And the prefixes and suffixes don't only modify the root of that word; they also modify the roots of subsequent words.
And that's why it has to be seen in context. If you're not seeing everything in the right context, all those supporting words, if you don't understand that, you lose the whole point. Mm-hmm. So what the big aha moment for me in understanding the Pali Canon was to recognize the consistency in the Buddhist teaching. And it is utterly consistent when you are aware of it. When you're not, you don't see it.
Well, that's a true linguist, is when you see the patterns.
And that's the important...
If there's a pattern within the Buddhist teachings, then you carry that pattern of context throughout the whole translation.
Yes, and one of the problems then is that people that don't get... There's some really good translators, and there's no need to mention their names. But they don't understand the basic Four Noble Truths. They never got that. Then your translations aren't going to relate back to that, will they? They can't. I have a cousin of mine. Again, I won't say his name. I shouldn't even say he's a cousin. He'll never listen to this. And he's one of the recognized scholars in the world on all Eastern religions. And I've read his books. They're really good books. They're really difficult reads. He's a brilliant guy. But they're almost of no value if you were going to develop the Buddha's Dhamma. They're just so far out of context. But they're very, from his point of view, they're very accurate looks at what took place back then. Mm-hmm. But they're not useful. You know, they're not useful as a Dhamma practice. So again, we have literature that's been, we talked about this, how the teachings of the Buddha were preserved and have been preserved in the same way all these years. But you still have to understand the context and what it's presented in. You know? And of course, and then when you read the Buddha's words, like just the simple words, I teach the understanding of suffering and the cessation of suffering. How can you get, you can't misinterpret it then when you hold that in mind. And he said that consistently, maybe thinking that it'd be too easy to misinterpret this unless I keep emphasizing this point. I teach the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering, nothing more. Over and over and over again. I teach a middle way. Over and over and over again.
Well,
I teach Four Noble Truths.
How pervasive fabrications were. So that was what he was banging his head up.
He might have been.
To plow through there.
Yeah.
Everybody that he spoke to.
And he saw the difficulty of the monks and nuns in his sangha, of even being part of the Buddha sangha, and the difficulty they were having in developing it. Keep coming back to the same point.
And it's real strong belief in a large consciousness with a large C and a self that continues on throughout eternity and some higher ordered all this.
And maybe there is, but it's of no value as human beings. Yep. I don't want to get into putting down my birth faith, but it was confusing. It was much more confusing than Buddhism.
It resolves you from some responsibility.
It resolves you of all responsibility. It does. I mean, it really does. That phrase... Oh, we probably shouldn't go here. It's an act of God.
Restrained.
Huh?
Yeah. Which side of the Mobius strip are you on?
I was reading it last night from Access to Insight on. I did a search on right speech again, and I was actually very interesting. You know, a ton of stuff comes up, but to not speak and not to discuss politics and all this stuff, which we know, but like anything that wars and famine,
let's not even bring those words into this room.
So,
but
that was what the guidance for a collective sangha.
Yeah, always talk about the Dhamma, or at least relate the Dhamma to what's coming up. Lorna brought that up the other day. There's a difference. There's a difference between observing, mindfully seeing what's occurring and mindfully observing what other people are doing and judging them harshly. One thing is an acknowledgement of the dukkha in the world. The other is saying it should be different or that person should be different. Two different things, but it's the same situation, isn't it? The Buddha did that often. In a very mindful but direct way. There's
idiot.
Well, there's a lot of references where the Buddha would say, he actually used the word idiot in the translation, but he would say, "You foolish man." But making the point that you're acting in a foolish way, the word fits. If you're looking at it from a judgmental point of view, it seems pretty harsh, doesn't it? If you're looking at it from a Dhamma point of view, it's the essence of love and compassion. You're acting foolish. Change. Do something different. Wow, what a remarkable retreat.
But with some people, that would be considered insightful. And even bringing up the concept of ignorance is insightful for people that are just ignorant of what you're, the reference that you're making to a certain type of ignorance. So maybe by the time you explain to them what the word was that you were using, they'll calm down.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, notice I don't have any trouble now using the word ignorant. It took me a while to become comfortable using it in a teaching setting. It was just because I don't want you to think I think you're ignorant. But that's not what the Buddha's saying.
Ignorant isn't the same as stupid.
It isn't.
Cold you want to stack it up very line. Ignorance of a certain type.
Yeah. It's ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And that's something that we have to face. We have to be willing to look at it. We have to accept that there's one thing that we're ignorant of. Four Noble Truths. And the other thing is to be consistent with our practice. Because the practice requires consistency. Is there anything else to say or do?
Mm-hmm. Metta.
We'll finish with metta.
Yes.
So, and you know what, we'll clean up the ground, etc., and then have lunch and acknowledge our, what's the right word, our gratitude for the folks up there that put this, keep this place going. All right.
Even though we're heretics in their eyes.
No, what Moore pointed out in the book that they have up there, they say that they use the Buddha's teachings and have adapted it to fit what they want to project to the world. And their statement really is to bring enlightenment to the world. Mm-hmm. So whether we agree with all of that, I think this is the first organization. This is my big problem. This is what I crave for and cling, that the institutions, the teachers, the lineages, the religions that have adapted the Buddha's teachings in some way would just say it, just like Guan Dharma Center says it. They don't make any bones about it. Mm-hmm. We took the Buddha's teachings and we made it this. That's great, because then people know, they at least they have the opportunity to then question, well, maybe let me look at what the Buddha taught too and see if I like it. Most of modern Buddhism is just the other way. This is the teachings of the Buddha, and we got a direct lineage back to him. That's the problem, because it doesn't allow for people to understand it's not and look for something different. So we'll give them metta too. Find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that have arisen from our retreat this weekend. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. In the Buddha's words on metta, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing and gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful retreat.
Thank you,
Joe.
Peace. Thank you, Joe.
But it's not quite over. I have a couple of questions. I've more or less decided that the forthcoming retreats are going to start on a Friday and end on Monday. Does anybody have any feeling about that one way or the other?
Say again.
The retreats will start on a Friday and end on a Monday rather than the Thursday to Sunday.
Okay. Why is that?
One of them is that a few people told me that they can't have a 3-day work week. So, but a 4-day week, I mean, to me it's the same, but a 4-day week work week makes it easier for them to take those two days off.
Okay.
I don't, you know.
And you could theoretically get here late on Friday night, you know, leave work at 5 o'clock and come up by 8.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Theoretically.
And then only being taken Monday off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't ever take 2 days off in a row with teaching, unless it's summer or over the...
So, but you could do that late, you come in late on Friday?
Yeah, totally. Right. I could do what I do this year. Yeah.
Yeah, and that worked out.
Yeah,
so.
Theoretically, yeah. You could, I considered not staying on Sunday, so, you know,
Well, then you'd miss this.
Like Friday, Monday would make it better for some people.
You'd have 2 false Saturday Sundays.
Mm-hmm. Missing a Monday is really critical for me, though. Monday launches the whole week.
Mm-hmm. All right, something to consider.
Right. But starting on Thursday and not needing to be here until later in the day, I can launch my day and then scoot out. But
and also work in the car on the way out.
Yeah, a little of that. So just for me, you know, this format is a little easier than missing a Monday.
Okay, I'll put some more thought to it then. And the other thought is just driving back on Sunday is always a little bit difficult on the thruway, or can be, because everybody's going south at that time. That's the only other practical reason. So, all right. And the other is I'm contemplating building and implementing an app, a Cross River Meditation Becoming Buddha app. Does that have any interest to you?
Yes.
Does it?
What would that do?
Well, what any app does. And so in one way it might supplant a newsletter, but maybe not. But you would get notifications on the app now of any changes, but also new articles. The weekly schedule would now be on the app.
So you'd also have access to... Because now when I'm walking on the trail in Frenchtown, I have to go to the... website, and then I look up the podcast and go from there. I don't know if there's an easier way to do that, but with an app, I would think I could just go to the app.
But even with Podbean, you go to Podbean, then you have to hit search, then you have to Cross River Meditation, then you gotta, even though that's...
You can't create just a permanent link to that?
Probably. and then all your meetings are right there.
All of that would be on the app.
So the app would streamline access choices
and announcements. Just like all the other, if there was something that I needed to convey, you'd get a number one on there. You know, there's something to look at. Mm-hmm. So that you'd find that useful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's not too much.
Can you also get at that point the newsletter would be in the app?
I haven't decided what I'd do. I'd probably send. Both, because I don't think everybody that gets the newsletter.
It creates more work for you, John.
It's not really, and you know, well, I mean, it's a little. Obviously, it's something else to do.
More people.
Well, that's the idea too. Yeah. You know, I think at some point it would be a payoff. What more and more people are not using even tablets anymore. It's just on a smartphone, so it would be much more useful that way. And I can track how people are accessing whatever I'm sending out, and right now it's probably about 55% or 60% smartphones, you know, and then different, and some on desktop, just a few on desktop now, and tablets. Tablets are going away; people aren't using them as much. You know.
I have a lot of my tablet.
Yeah. I still.
The phones
I still,
are getting bigger, though. So.
Yeah. And it's yeah. So I thank you for your feedback. I'm not sure when that's going to be implemented, but I just started looking at one particular app maker. See if I'm going to use it. So good.
App maker.
But I think the best part would be that all the content that's on the website would just be in the app. So you wanted to listen
right.
to something, you could just.
Well, like I recently referred someone, and I prepared an email to him of how I thought best to navigate things. You know, so certainly starting with your website. But I also told him about, you know, Podbean, and I also told him about YouTube. So. Again, it's up to him to, and then I gave him your number and contact information. So
oh, thank you.
It's still up to that person to do something with it. But.
Yeah, even the YouTube video should, well, I think they'll be also on the app,
yeah.
so you can
yeah.
just access everything through there.
Yeah. And of course it makes, not that appearances matter, but you're in the swim with everybody else who's doing something.
Oh yeah, I'm going to get that picture with the glow behind me right on it. Again, thank you all for a wonderful retreat.
Thank you.
Well,